The Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform for their 92nd state legislative session will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Rep. Johnson.
Present.
Rep. Edelson. Rep. Feist.
Present.
Rep. Grossel.
Present.
Rep. Hollins.
Present.
Rep. Hewitt.
Present.
Rep. Cleavorn.
Present.
Rep. Long.
Present.
Rep. Lucero.
Cheers.
Rep. Mueller.
Mueller present.
Rep. Novotny.
Novotny present.
Rep. O'Neill.
O'Neill present.
Rep. Pinto.
Present.
Present.
Rep. Poston.
Present.
Rep. Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Rep. Vang.
Present.
Rep. Shung.
Present.
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 Do we have an invader?
Present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niederhofer. And just to note that
I think we need help from our IT.
That was Representative Hewitt was off mute. Oh.
And that concludes the roll call, Chair. A quorum is present.
Very well. A quorum is present in both committees today. Members, this hearing is conducted under Minnesota House Rule 10.01, allowing for hearings to be held via use of distance voting, remote electronic voting, or voting by other means to protect the health and safety of the public, staff, and members. The hearing is streamlined on the House website and can be accessed via the committee page. Those wishing to offer public testimony can contact via email the committee administrator, Mr. Jamal Lundy, 24 hours prior to a hearing. That address is also available on our committee page. Members, our first side order of business.
Chair Mariani.
Yes, Lee Johnson.
I know this is the last Friday before deadline, and next week is deadline week.
Yep.
I'm just wondering if you could provide the committee with the path forward for next week so we could make some plans. Some people have issues or events already scheduled in their district. So if you can give us an idea of what next week is going to look like, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Appropriate question. Two things. One, we will not be having evening hearings tomorrow. I suspect that some of us will be pulled into evening hearings in other committees. This will not be one of them. The other thing is that, we just posted the, I'm being told, we just posted the schedule online. But the other thing on Friday, which is a committee deadline, as you noted, that's usually a pretty hairy day for members. What we're going to be doing on that Friday, what we're going to be doing on that Friday is hearing budget presentations from the guidelines, the post board, and I believe the ombudsperson's office, perhaps the private detective board as well. So there won't be any actions, I guess is what I'm saying, on that date. And hopefully that will then give members, flexibility because, I suspect, that Friday is going to be pretty demanding on us. And then jumping ahead, a heads up, we will continue to hear bills the following week, then we're headed into a second committee deadline. And at this point, I'm looking for us to begin the markup process the week after that, which would be the first week of April. But I'll certainly, as this continues to take shape, but it's looking pretty firm right now, Lee Johnson, I'll make sure that you're aware of how I'm approaching this. So no evening meetings next week, certainly a Friday meeting. It'll be a budget presentation meeting, and so members can obviously, prioritize where they might be needed in order to cast votes and offer amendments, et cetera. Lee Johnson.
Thank you very much. Our members appreciate it. Hopefully it'll be a smooth week next week.
Let's hope so. All right. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Frazier, would you be so kind as to move the minutes of March 17th?
So moved, Chair.
Very well. The minutes of March 17th are moved. Discussion? Representative Johnson, we're okay. Voice vote?
That would be fine.
Very well. All in favor of adopting the minutes of March, the minutes of March 17th, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes of March 17th are hereby adopted. Members, today, so we will not be taking up bills. We will not be making motions, at least not the chair doesn't intend to do that. What we will be doing is hearing from both the two departments that we have oversight of, the Public Safety Department of Corrections, for their budget presentations. I've asked both departments to limit their immediate testimony to 20 minutes in order to make sure that the members of this committee could then have, you know, some good time to be able to ask questions. I'm going to insist that we keep to those time parameters. If there's something not covered within 20 minutes, we can certainly attempt to come back to cover that during that question period of time. But this really is a good opportunity for members to get a deeper understanding of what the proposals are before us. I'm going to ask both departments to do their presentations back to back so that we are carving out equal time, but also making sure we get to that question period of time. So with that, I'm going to begin with the Department of Public Safety for their budget presentation, and I'm going to call forward Commissioner Harrington. Welcome.
Chair Mariani, members of the committee, thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. Happy Friday or happy National Sleep Day. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to serve all communities to build a safer Minnesota. We have been working together, and what I hope you will see in our budget is a more holistic approach to taking on that task. The Department of Public Safety is funded out of two different committees. Yours is the committee where folks think of public safety, particularly so alcohol, gambling, fire marshal, officer justice program, which is really speaks to the whole issue around victim services. And as much as some folks, I think, want to connote that public safety really speaks to law enforcement, the Department of Public Safety really is the state's victim services place. ECN, which supports our 911 for all first responders, Homeland Security Emergency Management, and then the BCA, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. On the transportation side, I'm not going to go into that in depth, although, once again, State Patrol and Office of Traffic Safety, while they are public safety related, they are funded out of the transportation side of the house. Next slide, please. When we thought about the budget for this year, we really wanted to take a more holistic approach to the budget. And so we looked at this using a lens that dates back from my days as a St. Paul cop, as a beat officer, and later as the chief, where we looked at it from the aspect of prevention, intervention, and enforcement. We really do believe that you really do need to have all three of these components, not just in part, but in a coordinated fashion if you wish to increase and enhance public safety. Prevention is the most cost-effective, but the hardest to prove, frankly. It's hard to prove causation on the prevention side, but almost everyone, if you ask them the question, would you rather not be burglarized or would you rather have the cops catch the guy that burglarized you? Would you not rather have someone prevent them from being struck or being arrested? They would say prevention is what they would like to see. And we believe that prevention really is important here, both in crime prevention, fire prevention, and in all hazards prevention in this budget. Intervention really speaks to the issue of the most, it's most impactful. And we think of it perhaps in terms of our drug abuse issues, but also in terms of youth crime and domestic violence. It is highly effective, especially if you're trying to reduce repeat offenders. And so those kinds of cases where we see repetition over and over again, intervention is absolutely a key component. And then finally, the most expensive and the tool that I think we should be seeking to use the least, which is targeted enforcement. Targeted enforcement really speaks to how do we incapacitate the most serious, the most repetitive, and the most violent offenders from being able to injure, harm, and take from other people. We have looked at this from a perspective that says we want to do all three of those things because we believe that if we do all three of them, not just one at a time, but do them in coordination, we'll see enhanced public safety. Next slide, please. At this point, I would like to hand it off to Director Kate Weeks, the Office of Justice Program, so she can go more in depth into the victim services and prevention intervention grants.
Thank you, Commissioner. Director Weeks, welcome.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Commissioner. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs. And I am here to talk a little bit about how we're going to accomplish what the commissioner just talked about. So what you're going to see in the governor's budget is increased investments in a couple of key areas related to grants. The first is we are looking at youth-focused investments. And so that is going to look at additional resources for youth development grants and youth intervention. It is going to look at is going to look like additional investments in disparity reduction funds. So that could be dedicated to reducing ethnic and racial disparities in the juvenile justice system and delinquency prevention programming. It could also look at, it also includes an investment in a crossover dual status youth model grant program. This is a program that is directly targeted at youth who have experience in the child welfare system in addition to the juvenile justice system. So really looking at what are the needs of those children and their families. We are also looking at additional investments in community crime prevention. So that looks like an increase in investment in our general crime support for victims of general crime. So that could be homicide, aggravated assault, carjackings. But we're also looking at, we see a need to stand up trauma recovery centers in Minnesota. After the truck park shooting in St. Paul, we do offer crime victim reparations in this state, but we also had a whole group of people that were traumatized by that shooting and really trying to find centralized services where we can, where people can go to receive the services they need, no matter where that happens in the state. And we are also looking at an increased investment in our community crime prevention grants. Currently, every time we have a competitive grant process, we have significantly more requests for funds than we have funds available. So we would like to increase that opportunity for community programs as well. We are also looking for additional investment in survivor supports. And so that is going to look like an additional investment for our program serving domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse. And that money will be going towards the needs that we're hearing the most for housing specialists, programming staff, support for programming staff, and increasing funding for those services throughout Minnesota. In addition, this will also help buffer any decline that we'll see potentially in federal funding. We are also looking at additional money for what is known as Minnesota HEALS. So that is an investment not only in providing a statewide community healing program, it will create a statewide critical incident stress management system for first responders and provide resources for families impacted by officer-involved deaths. We are also looking at increasing investment in looking at housing. One of the things that we are hearing the most, particularly with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, is safe, supportive housing outside of shelters. So, and the housing, it could be transitional housing, supportive housing, but also include resources in support of individuals looking to move on. And in order to do this, we are also looking at alternatives for juveniles. And so what the creative ways that we're looking at doing that is standing up community outpost or cop houses, similar to what is established in St. Cloud, where you're providing a space for community to come together with law enforcement for learning what services are available specific to your community. And also looking at investing in more true centers, which are opportunities for youth to come and learn conflict resolution, skills, access to services, and community healing. And we are also asking in the governor's supplemental budget an increase for county attorney training. Those costs are increasing and those needs for training are also increasing. And in order to do and support all of this, we are also asking for an investment in our staff. The Office of Justice Programs has an incredible amount of resources available, and we want Minnesotans and we want communities to know what that is, whether that be our Crime Victim Reparations Program, the RFPs or the buckets of money that we have available in grants. We want to be able to go into community and talk about how do you access those resources. So we're looking for additional outreach staff. We are also looking for support for our Statistical Analysis Center. Historically, those positions are funded by grants that we were able to get, but that limits the ability for that staff to only work on that grant-specific area. And we would like an ongoing investment. So in addition to what the legislature is looking for, the legislature wants to know, are our investments making a difference? What are the statistics? Are we making a dent in violence prevention and intervention or reducing ethnic and racial disparities in the juvenile justice system? So having staff available that can create those reports, do the analytics is so key to this work. And we are also looking for, in addition to all of this money, we need to be on top of our compliance. And so that is really working with all of our grantees, meeting all of the requirements that are needed to receive state and federal funding. Then also, as I talked about before, the need for housing services for victims of crime is number one in the state. And we currently have a temporary person working on issues of housing directly, not only with our state systems, but also our grantees and making that position permanent to support this work. And then knowing the need for youth in Minnesota right now, whether it be violence prevention, intervention, really staffing up and creating a bigger investment in the Youth Justice Office that was funded last year. Thank you. What we're looking at there is an additional staff person to work on reducing racial and ethnic disparities in our juvenile justice system, looking at, are those initiatives working? What do the stats say? Managing the grants, because we are asking for additional resources for this work, and then having a staff person specifically dedicated to working with the 11 tribal nations and community partners throughout the state on Native youth issues. And now I would like to hand it over to Superintendent Evans.
Very well, thank you, Director Weeks. And by the way, members, just a correction. We will take questions after each department's presentation. So just so members are prepared to be able to do that. I do apologize for earlier indicating that we would wait until the very end to do that. So just so you're prepared as we continue to listen to DPS for that. The trick is going to be making sure that we do that in a way that we then allow for good time for Department of Corrections that will follow afterwards. Just letting everyone know. Superintendent Evans, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members. I appreciate you having us today to provide this budget overview. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension works in partnership with our law enforcement partners to build a safer Minnesota. And it's over the past couple of years, we've experienced an increase in violent crime across the state of Minnesota. Homicides are up statewide from 2019 to 2021, 65%. Aggravated assaults, which would include shootings that don't result in a death, are up approximately 52%. And the numbers into this year are holding steady, if not slightly trending upward again in both of those categories. So what we've looked at in ways to provide support to our partners and communities across the state of Minnesota is to invest, as the governor recommends, in a violent crime reduction support initiative. And this would be a strategic data-driven approach to identify those that are committing the most violent crimes and repeat crimes, as the commissioner noted, across Minnesota through a three-pronged approach: forensics, analytics, and criminal enforcement teams that would focus on those most violent offenders. Our forensics unit at the BCA and our state laboratory has experienced a 30% increase in submissions to our DNA laboratory from 2019 to 2021. That part of this investment would be to provide additional resources to our DNA laboratory to keep up with the demand. But we would also look at a new front-end approach to get answers and information into the hands of law enforcement in a more quickly than we have in the past, through a new forensic intelligence response support and testing initiative that is aimed at getting information that may not be DNA identification, but would be getting things like NIBIN, which is our National Integrated Ballistics Information Network that tracks shootings across jurisdictions to provide leads that may lead to apprehending those that are committing shootings in particular more quickly than we have in the past. Right now, our DNA turnaround time is at 141 days for total as of last month, where our goal is always 30 days or less to get that out. We are working on a number of things, and you've provided investments in the past will help bring that time down to begin with, but also there's needed additional investments to keep that turnaround time where we'd like to see it and additional support in our firearms laboratory. The second prong of that investment would be in analytics to provide much more analytical support, which is often the key to that data-driven, specific scalpel approach that we've noted when we're looking at identifying those that are committing the most crime in a very strategic way so that we are not doing the dragnet approach of policing, that we're using analytics to drive exactly what we're looking at in terms of this. Now, when we think about violent crime at the BCA, we do think more broadly. It's not specifically just shootings that we see that are occurring in many of our communities across Minnesota, but we remain significantly concerned about threats to our faith-based institutions that we've seen across the United States, such as mass casualty events at our synagogues, mosques, and churches that have occurred in the past, and ways to identify information that would prevent those incidents from occurring. I've also seen an uptick in threats to our schools. Social media often drives those, but the criminal information and operations support section within our investigations division at the BCA play a critical role in coordinating information when those threats come in. And we've launched an app that gathers information about those threats to make that coordination across jurisdiction in Minnesota. And then threats to life that may occur, we have a partnership with the FBI that sends those threats to us, and then we coordinate with our local law enforcement. I'll also give a very relevant example and how this work is done across the state. Just yesterday, you saw a little two-year-old that was abducted in western Minnesota. This is the section that provides the critical support in those cases from activating the Amber Alert and then providing key support that led to people in a town that you'll hear more about, identifying an individual that they believe based on the Amber Alert and a whole host of analytical work that happened behind the scenes to provide information, identify the individual, and successfully locate that child, providing that support to our law enforcement. We think of these civilian criminal intelligence analysts as providing additional support to really be a force multiplier. Also, we were successful in solving a case recently about the little girl who was jumping on a trampoline, Trinity Otterson in North Minneapolis. We had an agent working on that case who executed nearly 100 search warrants in that case to gather information to identify the shooter in that case. Due to the lack of analytical support, the agent was doing that work, which is really best served by those civilian criminal intelligence analysts. The third prong of this is a violent crime enforcement partnership that would be comprised of 10 BCA agents and then full-time funding for 10 local agencies to provide a police officer to this partnership to work on violent crime. And it's organized in a way to be able to travel across the state of Minnesota. We designed this and put this in the BCA because it will be focused specifically on violent crime, shootings, carjackings, and homicide support in wherever that may be across the state of Minnesota. We did it at the BCA as well because we can sign longer term agreements so that the law enforcement agency that would assign an individual to this team can have some confidence that they can backfill behind so their community doesn't lose anything, but they gain additional support across their jurisdiction, both for their community, but then wherever that crime may exist across Minnesota. In addition, this team would have a prosecutor assigned to the team full-time to provide guidance, support, and then provide support to smaller jurisdictions in Minnesota should they need prosecutorial support in prosecuting some of these investigations that come from this team. And importantly, we have had one victim, family, and community services coordinator in the BCA focusing on our force investigations unit that you funded, And we have found that support to be vitally important in that work. And this proposal adds three additional positions to provide support to families across Minnesota as they experience violent crime, to connect them with services and resources that would be available to them as they experience some of these types of crimes in Minnesota. Lastly, moving on to this Commission on Accreditation. So again, just to recap, forensics, analytics, and enforcement is what the prong would be to have that strategic data-driven approach that will have the data guide us to those individuals committing that crime. Part of the things that we've looked at as well is ways to improve and continually improve our delivery of our services in Minnesota is this Commission for Accreditation on Law Enforcement. We're seeking one FTE that the governor recommends be funded to seek accreditation for not only our laboratory, that's been accredited for many years, but all of the BCA processes and services that we conduct, our law enforcement services at the BCA. What that does is we would implement standards and policies to ensure we are meeting standards of that accrediting body to prove through our documenting our work that we are doing what we say we do day in, day out through an audit process that would look at those accreditation standards. You can go to the next slide. Another piece in the governor's budget that would be housed in our BCA training section is something that the commissioner noted as he was working on the Deadly Force Encounters Working Group. He noted as he traveled across the country that he saw these simulation trailers or simulation exercises that are real-time, real-life experiences that are training peace officers when they encounter whether or not to use force and what level of force to use through this simulation experience. This funding would provide funding to be able to bring this type of training across the state of Minnesota, as it is an expensive piece that doesn't always make sense for small jurisdictions, but this would provide funding to travel across the state of Minnesota to do this. And the last piece of the BCA's budget is cybersecurity upgrades that will provide infrastructure, data service, storage, disaster recovery, and a new identity access management system within the BCA. This is something that you have funded. It was not fully funded in the request, and so this would be the remainder to upgrade our cybersecurity, which remains a continual concern to us at the BCA as we continue to see as global events unfold. We have significant unwanted traffic and those that wish to cause harm to our government systems trying to intrude into some of the most sensitive data that we house here at the state of Minnesota on Minnesotans, and so this would bolster those defenses and ensure we're doing everything we can to protect the data and the data integrity of our systems across Minnesota. And with that, I will move it back to Commissioner Harrington.
Commissioner Harrington, we're really tight on time. I'd like to get over to questions, but please, Commissioner.
I'll speak as quickly as possible, although there was a little time taken for other announcements. So Homeland Security Emergency Management is also part of our cause. There are three funding programs we'd like you to consider. First Responder Wellness Office. Drew mentioned the Deadly Force Encounters. One of the aha moments there was that when the moms who had lost loved ones to police-involved shootings and the chiefs came together, they both identified that healthy cops are absolutely essential component here. This really speaks to broader than healthy cops. It's more than just mental health for officers. This really speaks to first responders. And I can tell you, having met with firefighters, fire chiefs, EMS folks, this is necessary across the board. And it's not simply just funding for police, but it would do peer-to-peer counseling, critical incident stress management, and co-responder models, which also are necessary as we try and address the whole issue of how shall we respond when someone is in crisis and their family is calling for help. Is the police the right group, or should somebody else come? Mutual aid and mutual agency emergency response training is the second prong of that. If you think about the studies that are being done, and you'll see some coming out shortly, the after action reports that we have looked at, including the most recent one from Minneapolis, has called into question, do senior officials really understand how to call for mutual aid and call in Minnesota National Guard or other resources? This would produce new training that we would be able to provide, not just on the online National Incident Management System, but also coordinate that with local sheriffs, emergency managers across the state. We believe this is really essential because it is clear that not all of the elected officials, local elected officials, understand what's necessary for the state and other federal resources to step in their hour of need. Finally, the last of this is the local government emergency management grants. And these would be grants that would be given to all 87 counties, 11 tribes, and the four cities of the first class that would allow them to have support for their emergency managers. We require that each of these entities have an emergency manager, but there is no state dedicated funding to help them meet that requirement. And so this would allow them to have state support, but it is set up as a reimbursement fund, and it is set up so that they would, if they're already paying for this out of their own general fund or their own property taxes, they would not be able to supplant with these dollars, but it would allow those agencies that either have a part-time or no full-time to be able to bring in a full-time emergency management program. And on that note, alcohol gambling enforcement. This is additional positions to increase retail liquor license enforcement. We saw lots of need around this during the pandemic. This will allow us to not only just be more responsive to enforcement complaints, but also go back to doing proactive inspections and educational visits. And then from the state fire marshal, this funding would be used to fill a budgetary shortfall for explosive security. One of the areas that we're seeing is more and more often, we're getting requests for sites inspections and site security around bomb squads that would include canine sweeps, protective dignitary explosive sweeps, and then explosive security at large events. And we are the home of many large events here in the state of Minnesota. And so this would allow us to fill a gap there.
Very well. Thank you, Commissioner. I do appreciate you and your staff moving officially through this. Why don't we just jump right in then? I'll begin with Representative Polston, followed by Representative O'Neill. Representative Polston.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My question is for Commissioner Harrington. Commissioner Harrington, I'm going to start with a statement and then a few questions. I've always been of the mind that when we do a supplemental budget in the off-budget year, that it's for emergency-type items. A lot of these don't seem at all like an emergency-type item to me. We did the largest budget in state history less than a year ago, and here we are asking for a huge amount of money. So I would like your thoughts on that, but I'd also like to understand how many FTEs are going to be added to your agency with all of these programs and all of these expansions that you're putting forward?
Commissioner?
Representative Polston, I do appreciate that. And I would argue that we are in emergency times, that this is, that we are at a critical juncture. You look at the two biggest cities in the state, they both had either a record or broke the record for the number of homicides, and they are asking for state assistance to try and respond. When we look at firefighters across the state, many of those agencies are saying to us they can't keep people because they're losing them to PTSD and cancer and to other ailments that way. When we're looking at crisis in our churches and our synagogues, we are seeing over and over again, crisis has come up that we did not plan for the last biennium. And I believe we really do need to be able to be responsive to the increased number of victims, the increased number of cases, and the calls from local communities for state assistance when they're not finding any way for them to do this themselves. So that would be my answer to why you see us pushing and leaning in on this budget. It simply is, I don't think anyone expected to see 97 murders in Minneapolis or over 35 murders in St. Paul. And we certainly didn't expect to see the crisis in carjackings and other things there. In answer to the FTE question, I'm going to have to get back to you. I do not have that answer right at my fingertips, but I will get it for you and either get it to you in the chat if I can get it immediately or get it back to you as quickly as possible.
Representative Polston.
Commissioner Harrington, and you know, I agree with you that we have some emergencies, and I agree that there are some provisions in here that pertain to emergencies. I think there are some things in here that you know are really kind of questionable as to whether they're emergencies. Things like money set aside for legalizing adult use cannabis. You know, I don't think that's going to go anywhere this session, and I'm wondering why we're putting some money into this budget for that, for instance. that doesn't seem like an emergency at all to me.
Representative Poston, I appreciate your perspective on that. And what I will tell you is that what we're seeing is the lab being unable to be responsive to some of the legalization or being prepared for the legalization if it does in fact take place. So our crime lab, our OTS folks, our traffic folks all have to be prepared for that. And so when would we put that in if we don't put it in advance of possible legislation? So I'm not going to disagree with you that that is not at a crisis point because it hasn't been legalized, but we do feel it was prudent to try and put it in advance of what could happen. So we're trying to be predictive or at least lean in a little bit on that one.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for being with us this morning. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Poston. These are all appropriate questions. It's about what choices we're going to make and what filters are we going to apply in making those choices. So appropriate line of questioning. Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first couple questions is actually for Director Weeks. And as she was giving her presentation, I realized that I've not ever visited OJP, which is crazy that I haven't done that. And so I'm realizing that I'm not fully understanding as she's explaining everything that she wants to do and expand, because quite frankly, I haven't been there to see what programming they do and understand that. Now, I've been in my own community and I've gone to like violent centers where women come and find shelter and get support. So I get that side of it. But my question is, when you said something about combating racial disparities, I don't really understand, like, can you give me an example of what that means? And then the second question I have is, you talked about grants that sound a lot like YIPA grants. And is that an expansion of YIPA or is that different? Those are the two questions for Director Weeks.
Very well, Director Weeks.
Thank you, Chair and Representative O'Neill. First, I would love to meet with you and talk about what OJP does. We should definitely get that scheduled. So the first question with reducing racial disparities. And so Minnesota, the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs is the administrator of Title II funds from the federal government. And under those laws, there's a couple of prongs to it. One is, you know, compliance, making sure that youth are separated from adults in detention facilities. But one of the other tenets is making sure that states are working towards reducing ethnic and racial disparities in the juvenile justice system. And what that means is there's an overrepresentation of Black, Native American, Latino, Asian children in our systems. And so really looking at what do we need to do to change that overrepresentation. So that can look like a lot of things. It can look at diversion programs. So instead of putting a child into the juvenile justice system, are there other opportunities? It could work. It could look at, we look at it too more holistically, like how do we prevent youth from being in situations? So is that mentorship? Is that job opportunities? Is it training? Similar to what YIPA does. And so those are the things, we would like to increase Minnesota's investment in those strategies. So you're not having an overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system. And then for the youth, the additional youth investment that we are asking for is slightly different than the traditional YIP program because we're not asking for a match. So we're trying to make sure for those organizations that might not have the resources to make the match that is required under the YIP statute, that they would have access to these resources. Similar to what Commissioner Harrington said and Superintendent Evans talked to, a lot of our crime is being committed by youth right now. So we're trying to get resources out to organizations that provide other opportunities for youth.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, that helps. And yes, I absolutely have to come visit because as you're talking, I'm realizing I don't have any visual cue. I'm very visual. I don't have any visual things that was coming up in my memory because I haven't spent the time to really dig in to see what you do. I've been to programming out up into St. Cloud and different things like that, but that helps with what you just said. Conversely, though, I have spent a lot of time at the BCA over my years, 10 years now in this committee, have spent a lot of time at the BCA. And when Superintendent Evans talked about different components, I could quickly understand what he was saying because I literally just went there over my vacation So I have this weird thing of, I'm a little bit of a workaholic, and this year, our vacation, we went to Bemidji. So I got to see some things there, and I got to see finally the field office for the BCA. And Superintendent Evans, you were talking about the data analysis of, and how important that is, and how you've got, you know, just as an example of this poor child that was shot on the trampoline, and how many hours and hours and hours the investigator had to spend in analyzing all the data. And I would say, kind of bouncing off of what Representative Hosen just said, if anything in this whole budget is getting to the heart of the crisis, it's in the BCA's ask of about $10 million or so, and adding 44 FTEs so that we can analyze the data, analyze the DNA, do expand the ballistics information, because that really gets to the heart of trying to close some of these cases. It's a very low closure rate in Minneapolis and St. Paul with their murder rates. So there are obviously ongoing investigations, but the closure rate hasn't been great. And we certainly acknowledge, I believe, that there is an absolute crisis in Minneapolis and St. Paul and the surrounding areas and suburbs and even out to greater Minnesota. So if we were going to put any money anywhere, I would hope that we would put it squarely in the center of what the BCA is doing, because they are utterly overwhelmed with the amount of data coming in. That's all I have to say. And I don't know if Superintendent Evans wants to say anything. I don't really have a question, because I actually understood his whole presentation, because I've spent the time to go there and analyze and study and learn what they do. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. I'm going to keep pushing with the questions. And again, members, appropriate conversation. This is about the choices and the priorities and the filters that we use, and we should absolutely share that with one another. I would add a little bit thing, however, being a St. Paulite, St. Paul closure rate is actually pretty good. The closure rate on the other side of the river, not so good. Representative Feist, followed by Representative Otney. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Superintendent Evans as well. I was curious, I have the handout that was provided regarding the BCA's funding request, and it includes $2.4 million per year for the Fusion Center. And I was just curious, what type of information is available to the public in terms of the number of cases, types of cases, the nature and extent of information sharing that the Fusion Center does? Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Evans.
Chair Mariani, Representative Feist, thank you for the question. So the funding that is in here, and I know that this is a discussion that's ongoing, just to describe for the group in terms of how we're organized, we have a criminal information and operations section. These are the civilian criminal intelligence analysts that provide support both through our Fusion Center, but also in our reactive criminal cases, and then all the other information sharing, analysis, and dissemination that we do. These FTEs we put into the criminal information operations section. The Fusion Center is our federal component that is an information sharing hub that was created after 9/11 to provide assistance to ensure that we don't miss information along the way. These individuals would go into that criminal information operation support. So they're providing broad support in this violent crime as proposed here. In terms of your question, to be more specific about what information is available, we certainly, all of them are subject to the Minnesota Data Practices Act. So in the same way that we would provide information on any of our criminal investigations, this section, this unit, is subject to the same thing. In terms of our work that we do, we have a very strong privacy policy that I believe was distributed to the group today that governs our use in terms of intelligence with this group. And we do not track individuals unless they are subject or part of an active criminal investigation. And then the individuals that on the reactive side are providing support to our law enforcement component. We've recently completed internally an audit to ensure that we are complying with that, and we are providing and we are planning for an external audit in the next year to ensure that we are adhering to that privacy policy. Another component, while we're talking about the budget today, is the policy proposal that you all heard in terms of expanding the role of our advisory board at the BCA. And one of the roles that that expanded authority would give them is to provide a review and audit, or review, advice, and input input on any audits that we would be conducting at the BCA. And so that's one of the other components, again, and the accreditation piece that we have here today is another guardrail that we believe will ensure that we are continually working on some of those. But I've worked with ACLU, Minkoji, and others to have discussions about a number of these and certainly open to conversations to ensure that the public and policymakers like yourself are always receiving adequate information about the work that we do. Because again, these individuals are really tasked with providing support in our violent crime work across the state.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent Evans. I do always get a little bit concerned just from that civil libertarian perspective about data sharing. And it is reassuring to hear that there is an external audit that you're conducting. I think it would be really great to have that be an ongoing expectation that there would be that external party that would just provide us with high-level data, not specific about the individuals, but just understanding the number of cases, type of cases, that type of information. I think that would be really reassuring to the general public so that we understand the operations at a high level. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist. I like your idea of the ongoing, the suggestion of an ongoing review of that type. Representative Novotny, followed by Representative Pinto. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And briefly, it wasn't going to be part of my thing, but in the 2.5 years that I supervised the intelligent unit at Sherburne County, I've never been more audited in my life between. you really had to have your T's crossed and your I's dotted because you're answering to multiple agencies at state and federal levels that every time you access a bit of information, it's got to be accountable and tracked. So. But moving forward, my question is going to be for Director Weeks. We've got a very large amount of money going towards your program. Looks like about $50 million total and $79 million in the tails going forward. A lot of the things, as Representative Poston and Representative O'Neill pointed out, that supplementary budgets are for emergent situations that we have to deal with, like the need for the BCA to increase the crime lab, and that's already been covered, so I won't belabor that. But I look at, you've got, it's like $2 million going the first year, and then for alternatives to juvenile detention. Now, knowing that almost no juveniles are being detained unless it's a severe case of violence right now in the juvenile court systems, who are we going to be diverting that's already not being diverted? Could you address that quickly?
Commissioner, Director Weeks.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Novotny. So these funds, for juvenile justice diversion grants, we receive approximately $900,000 from the federal government to work on these initiatives, whether it be compliance, reducing ethnic and racial disparities, and creating diversion and delinquency intervention and prevention programs. There is more need than there is funding available. And so what we're asking is an increase in funding to meet the need that we are seeing in Minnesota. And for example, too, I know that we, in front of you is a big increase in asks, a lot of in different buckets of funding. But so one of the things, like with the youth development grants, I know for YIPA in the last competitive cycle, there was about $6 million available, and we received over $12 million in requests. And with community crime prevention in the last competitive cycle, there was $2.4 million available, and we received over $6 million in requests. And we are seeing this continually in many of our grant buckets when we go through these competitive cycles. So in this time of need, we know that need is there, and so we are trying to meet that need.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you, Director Weeks. So would it be fair to say that this is more of not a detention diversion or alternative, it's more doubling down on the YIP program?
Director Weeks.
Chair Representative Novotny. So what it is, these are programs, these are initiatives that are working with the youth. And so instead of putting the youth in the juvenile justice system, they're providing alternatives to incarceration. They're providing alternatives to having children go into custody. And those can be a variety of different things. It could be mentorship, it could be job development, it could be tutoring, it could be, there's a lot of different ways depending on that child and depending on that community, what services are available. So that is what that money is doing, is supporting the community programs. And I do believe maybe even some government-led initiatives for those youth. So they're not going into a custody situation, whether that be jail or prison.
Representative Abbey.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you, Director Weeks. Can you give me one situation where you could could reasonably see that there would be a juvenile diverted through your program that already is not being placed in juvenile detention right now?
Director Weeks, and then we're going to move on to the next question, Director.
So, members, yes, Representative Nemotny, I can follow up with you. One of the things that I'm looking at right now is the list of our Title II grants. And one of those is for the Minnesota Alliance with Youth that provides a lot of opportunities for youth to, and in partnership, for diversion activities. And I'd be more than happy to follow up with you with a list of examples that further, and I can share that with the committee as well, which I think would be really helpful so you can see across Minnesota where those investments are going and what they're doing, because it's broad. It's not one size fits all.
Thank you, Director Weeks. As you can tell, our committee has does a good inquiry process. I'm glad that we're having this conversation. Representative Pinto, followed by Lee Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Director Weeks as well. And I'll note I've had the chance to work with her and her staff a lot through the years, and just they do incredible work. And so, Director Weeks, two things relating to youth justice. I guess a follow-up on Representative Votney's question, because it seems to me that youth diversion may not be diverting youth simply from being in custody, but from certain aspects of the court process that is sort of broader than the question you were being asked. And then I guess I'll have a follow-up question about youth justice issues. But can you just clarify that in follow-up to Representative Lavani's question?
Director Weeks.
Chair members, and I know there's a lot of overlap in what the Office of Justice Programs is doing right now. So we have several different ways that we are interacting with youth. And a lot of the terms that are used provide some overlap. And so under the Title II grants, oftentimes those initiatives are called juvenile diversion or juvenile or alternatives to delinquency or delinquency prevention. But we also operate, we have the youth intervention grants, which are also focused at youth more on the prevention side. And so we have multiple streams of funding that are going to organizations, local units of government, maybe even county services that are addressing, working with youth along a continuum. Some people call it the cradle to corrections continuum. Where are those different places in the system where we can prevent youth from ending up in prison, right? And so it could be prevention. It could be working with after-school programs. It could be working, it could be further along. So if someone is arrested, do they go to jail or do they go to an alternative solution where you are working with mentors, doing alternatives to being incarcerated? So it is truly a continuum, and there is overlap. And organizations could be working with youth that might fall in many places along the continuum. And there might be some specifically being like if a youth, if they are facing jail time or an alternative, they might be more focused on that aspect. So it is a broad continuum, and we can definitely provide more information, I think, to the committee to kind of look at all of those different pieces that we fund, organizations that we work with, and examples. Be more than happy to provide that.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so my main question then, which I think will be short as well, is I really am pleased by the proposal for crossover and dual jurisdiction grants to address that issue. I like it so much that I have a bill that clones your proposal. And my only question for you is, if funding is available, I would think that even more can go to that. I think the proposal is for $1 million. Am I right in thinking that that even substantially more could go to that to help address youth delinquency and challenges with youth and get them on the right path. Could you just comment on that?
Director Weeks, and then we'll move on to the next question.
Chair Mariani, Representative Pinto, yes, absolutely.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Weeks.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Lee Johnson, and then we'll wrap it up with Vice Chair Frazier. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Commissioner Harrington, and the others, thank you for being here today. I don't even know where to begin. We really don't have enough time to actually go through a proposal with 26 different items in it in this short a time period. We've barely even scratched the surface on this. But one question I do...
Fair enough, Lee Johnson noted. We certainly will spend a lot of time with this budget as we move into our markup process, but please proceed.
First of all, I want to thank Superintendent Evans for being here. His staff and his agents at BCA are phenomenal. They do great work. I'm glad they caught the individual who shot, trying to remember her name now, the young lady on the trampoline. Trinity, she has family that I went to school with in this area. Hopefully they can get Nicholas Ingersoll too, as he lived just 1 mile from my house. I do have a couple different questions for for Superintendent Evans. First of all, you talked about the increase in homicide and gun violence and gunfire. I'm just wondering if you could provide the committee with a breakdown on county by county with that information as well, so you have a better understanding where it's happening. And if you know where a large part of that is happening right now.
That's like important data to have. Superintendent Evans, very quickly.
Chair Mariani, Lee Johnson, I appreciate the question. The data that has not been completed for 2021 statewide. So we did pull data that we pulled for the Twin Cities metropolitan area that we referenced before. I will note for you, I mean, I gave the numbers at the beginning, the statewide increases over the last couple of years. I will note that the Twin Cities metropolitan area, which I think is a part of your question, has experienced a much higher rate of violent crime over the last few years. And I would, you know, I would classify that as, you know, the Twin Cities area as the larger metropolitan area. I will note for this committee, something that we've been working on, that by the end of April, we're launching what's called a Crime Data Explorer. It's live right now, so you're welcome to go in and look at that online for bias-related offenses, a number of different offenses that we've released, but all of the crime data will start to be reported on a monthly basis. We're in the process of finalizing that right now. So I apologize not having the details for you, Representative Johnson, but I don't have the specifics. We're targeting kind of the May timeframe to have the complete report, but the Twin Cities area has experienced a larger increase in violent crime compared to the rest state up over the last couple of years.
And Superintendent, I was going to ask you about where members can go on a regular basis to view whatever it is that we have. And so if you could, thank you for sharing that. If you can, further provide us the link, I'll make sure that all committee members have that. Lee Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Commissioner Harrington, you talked about the firefighters and the issue especially in Greater Minnesota. Minnesota, we're 90% volunteer firefighters. The biggest issue cities are having is the commitment that it takes to become a firefighter now. OSHA regulations have made it so if you do full-time just the training, it takes 6 months to get through all the training to get started on a fire department. Otherwise, to do the normal training as a volunteer time, because they're volunteering their time to take this training, I can take up to 2 years before that person can actually start actually working fires, other than just standing by maybe handing equipment and being a gopher on scene. So we have a huge problem with that. And unfortunately, it's the regulations OSHA has put in place that are making it more difficult for our locals and our small cities and their small fire departments to get people willing to volunteer. And without those volunteers, I don't know if we'll have a fire department. It's great that our businesses and in our small communities allow their employees, when that pager goes off, to go fight those fires and run the medicals, because the ambulance services, we can now, in some places in Minnesota, it's a 45-minute wait for an ambulance. So the fire departments have been stepping up and doing that. But that's also taken away from businesses that might have a critical person that's on that fire department that has to respond to those. So it's an issue. I don't know if you've seen the OLA report on ambulance service, but it's affecting our fire service because of how bad that's the issue going there. We also, some of my questions are for the next section. I'm trying to find the question I had written down. I can't. Trying to read my chicken scratch without my glasses can be difficult at times.
As a nearsighted individual, I empathize with you, Lee Johnson.
One of the concerns I have is the huge increase in this budget. And I'm concerned that on the public safety side, find my numbers here. Just on public safety, for the rest of this biennium, with this proposal, it's almost $50 million. Or correction, over $76 million. And over $111 million in the tails for next biennium. That's a huge percentage of the normal budget that we have right now. Last year we fully funded our departments. So it makes me wonder what's going on. I do have another commissioner question as well for Commissioner Harrington. We were under lockdown for the last couple of years, and in this proposal budget recommendation, I think it's $150,000 a year for our bomb squad. I don't know if they were used that much during the lockdown. They were used some with the deficiency, but what this supplement is three times their normal budget, and it's increasing their base to that amount. I just wonder if you could respond to that.
Commissioner, if you can perhaps address a couple of the issues that you heard here, and then members, we are going to push. I want to get Vice Chair Frazier in for the last question. I want to make sure we're honoring the Department of Corrections.
Chair Mariani, Representative Johnson, absolutely. We believe about 70% of the state's firefighters are part of the volunteer corps. And in talking to them, a lot of what you see in our budget is grants that go straight through us back to the community. And so this budget was largely developed with community based on what they said they needed. That drove the need for training. We're having conversations with firefighters around regional fire, around some really innovative ways of training new firefighters. In regards to the bomb squad, we have seen an increase in bomb threats, whether that is to schools or to other places. And so I believe we did have a significant need for the bomb squad. The Alina Clinic is just one rather poignant example of where that happened. But the bomb squad is utilized on a regular basis. And as those threats have continued to percolate, when we have large public gatherings, which we're now going back into, many of those bomb squads and the canine detection units that supported them have needed additional resources because they're being called in to do things over several weekends or over major events. So I really do believe that we are very much this budget, while it has an increase, we don't deny that at all. It is an increase that's been driven by community need and is responsive to community need.
Very well. Representative Frazier, you get the last question and comment here, and then we're going to move quickly. Please.
Yeah, just I'll go real quickly, Chair. Thank you. I've got a couple of questions and then a comment. The comment wise, I just want to say, I want to thank DPS and particularly Superintendent Evans. I was pleased to see the governor move toward the date certain on body cam footage being released. I even know the law enforcement lobbyists, they agree that we should have a date certain on when that information should be released. So I appreciate that, and I'm happy to carry the bill that you put over, and I've introduced that bill. So looking forward to working on that. You know, one piece I do want to talk about is that there's a couple of reports, one investigation, and there's a after action report that's out there that I, as you all know, I've been asking for those reports. And the reason I've been asking those reports is because we're being asked to vote on enormous amounts of money here for law enforcement. And I don't disagree with funding law enforcement. In fact, I have over $70 million in the bill that I'm authoring going towards law enforcement. So that's not the issue. But I do believe when we're looking to invest these type of resources, we should have the most up-to-date and informed information we have as possible that involves recommendations so that we know that what, so we can apply policy to the resources that we are providing based on those recommendations. I hear the Wilder report, and here's a question. I hear the Wilder report will be coming soon. And just, can I get an answer from someone if we believe that report will be here at least by March 31st?
Commissioner?
Yep. Chair Mariani, Representative Frazier, having visited with Wilder, we're waiting for the PDF to be finished and for them to make it accessible. And we are absolutely certain that we will have that before March 31st. So that is, in fact, correct. In addition to that, we've already posted after action reports, two after action reports and an outside report from 21CP. And those are all been posted publicly, as will the Wilder report also.
Nice, Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Commissioner Harrington. Yes, and thank you for the after-action reports that have been posted. We've been going through those, and we'll follow up with questions around that. But thank you for that on a Wilder piece. And then my last comment, I am very pleased to see the resources that are being suggested or proposed for our youth, for the diversion programs and the work that you're going to do there, because I think it's vitally important to have places and structured places, positive places for our youth. I benefited greatly from those as a youth growing up in Chicago. Commissioner Harrington may know about some of those that I had the opportunity to experience, and it greatly impacted my life in a positive. The one thing I will say in regards to the cop houses, the one comment I have about that, I understand how they operate. The one thing I'd like to see is to focus our resources on service providers that have the background and the expertise to work with our youth. Nothing against the cop houses, but I will be taking a look at that as we go through the budget and determining what we push forward and what we kind of have some ideas about maybe doing differently. So thank you, everyone. Superintendent Evans, Commissioner Harrington, Director Weeks, thank you all for being here today. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frazier. Commissioner Harrington, last few seconds, then we're going to move on to the Department of Corrections.
Chair Mariani, members of the committee, we appreciate your time today. We really do believe this was a community-driven budget. This has been driven by conversations with community. It is focused on getting resources that will assist the community, and we believe that it is timely and needed to address both the violent crime in the immediate, but also to try and do prevention work that will stop the increase in violent crime and, in fact, intervene in the lives of young people and those that are most in need. And so we are very much supportive of the conversation. We are happy to have engage in this conversation and in others to make sure that you understand fully the commitment of the Department of Public Safety to keeping Minnesotans safe.
Thank you, Commissioner. Look forward to our ongoing engagement on this budget request. Thank you to the entire team for being here with us today. Members, we're going to move on to the Department of Corrections. We've been able to secure another 15 minutes from our wonderful house IT, so we should be able to get the full report from the Department of Corrections, and then hopefully we'll get some good questions as well. With that, we have Commissioner Snow. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here. Paul Schnell from the Department of Corrections. So, Chair and members, 2 years ago, March 15th, 2020, the Department of Corrections activated its incident management team to provide agency-wide coordination of our response to the COVID-19 pandemic for Minnesota's correction system. At that same time, each of our 10 prisons, 11 if you count the Little River facility, set up its on-site command post to operate 24 hours a day to ensure the continuity of operations as the pandemic progressed. That incident management team and those staff continue to operate today. Even this morning, I had the opportunity to visit Stillwater Prison with Commissioner Malcolm and talk with a few staff and talk with some of the incarcerated about the need to kind of how we plan to move forward. It has been two long years and around the clock. I just want to indicate that our corrections staff in these prisons and in field services, many of whom I'm sure are watching today, I want to make sure that I take a moment to recognize them, their service. Corrections work is difficult under the best of circumstances, and COVID really created immense challenges for them. And for the last 2 years, we've seen them work under incredible pressure, oftentimes more risk, an incredible level of dedication to wanting to make a difference to those who are in our field, in our prisons, as well as under supervision. And our staff have lived through this, oftentimes enduring immense levels of testing, illnesses, quarantines, isolations, and colleagues even who have lost their lives to this virus. And I know they're weary and exhausted, and oftentimes have felt overwhelmed. But I wanted to take this opportunity to at least publicly call out their service and to make sure that in front of this body who oversees this, this function, how important and how grateful I am and proud I am to be have the opportunity to work with them over the last 3 years, and in particular the last two as we manage COVID. So to them, their families, I just want to say thank you. Chair and members, today we're presenting our budget, and this is a budget that invests in the work of our dedicated staff. And I want to really frame this in a way that we want to presenting a budget that really invests in what works, what makes a real difference. While I present the budget that invests in this important work, we have to recognize, and you all realize, that the work of public safety doesn't start or end with corrections. It's comprehensive, and I think it's appropriate that DPS and DOC are being heard on the same day, because it is a continuum. It is part of the system. To transform lives for Minnesota, for a safer Minnesota, we have to make long-term and comprehensive approach to how we address the causes of crime and disorder, and while at the same time making sure that we take the steps to address the very real uptick in violence that we're seeing in communities across our state and really across our nation. The work of the legislature in creating a safer Minnesota, as you know, does not end in this committee either. It exists in Representative Pinto's committee and with early childhood, and that upstream work and energy that has to be placed by investing in education of our children, strengthening our families and communities, and the physical and mental health of people in our communities. These are all elements of creating really important public safety. As it relates to the work of DOC, it means that we need to have safe and secure prisons in order to deliver these services to the incarcerated. And we need those services delivered professionally by our corrections agents across the state. To hold people accountable and to transform lives, we can't simply be concerned about how much time people spend in our prisons. We have to be focused on how that time is used. And that's why this budget invests in what works. And with that, we'll just open up a slide and we'll walk through some of the elements of the budget. So I want to just mention that our Chief Financial Officer, Chris Dodge, is with me here today to respond to any technical questions that you may have. Some of these proposals you've already heard a bit about. Next slide really talks about this Justice Reinvestment Initiative. The governor and the DOC request the recommendation for equitable funding and evidence-based practices and community supervision to be funded in full. early last year, a partnership between AMC, the House and Senate leadership, judicial branch, and the governor invited the Council of State Governments in to use their justice reinvestment model to take a deep dive into supervision delivery in the state of Minnesota. The collaboration was built around common interests and the need to ensure that supervision across our state addresses and creates poor public safety outcomes and is equitable in how services are delivered and ensures a base level of funding. You're going to hear more about this next week, so I won't go into the details today, and I look forward to that discussion in which the counties will be participating. In order to support GRI work and the recommendation, there is an initial budget request specific to the DOC under the governor's correctional supervision request. Our grants and subsidies needs must adjust also significantly to address the justice reinvestment recommendations. Our grants and subsidies unit is very small, and the DOC is requesting funds to develop a grants management system, to procure one, as we're the only state agency without one, though we currently administer approximately 250 grants and subsidies and contracts with the reimbursements totaling almost $80 million. In addition, we're requesting funds to ensure the effective stewardship of public funds by increasing our capacity to administer the dollars that are sent out and appropriated to us by the legislature. Next, we want to highlight the importance of safety and security in our facility and talk about the advantages of body-worn cameras. As you all know, the advantages in law enforcement are well documented. There's been an increase in use of body cameras and corrections work as well. And there is some really substantial benefits for staff and facility safety. The DOC is seeking $1 million, $1.5 million in the next fiscal year and $2 million ongoing to equip our staff with body cameras. It should come as no surprise to this committee that the DOC is pushing this proposal to increase the safety of staff, which, as you will recall, in the 2020 OLA report on the safety and security in our prisons, highlighted the need for technology of this kind. And there have been studies done on body cameras, even outside of the police context, that show improved safety for those staff wearing cameras. In fact, Olmsted County's jail facility recently implemented body-worn cameras, and their chief deputy, Brian Howard, who oversees the detention facility, was quoted in the media saying, quote, "It really did make it safer in our facility, not only for our staff, but for our detainees," end quote. And I think it's really, this is an important thing for, we believe, for the safety of our staff. Next, a proposal you have seen before, and it had passed through this committee and on the House floor last year, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. This is the Minnesota Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, which invests and provides incentives for people completing transformative program, which we know reduces risk of reoffense. The proposal not only allows us to invest our limited resources in what we know works, it also redirects those resources to the areas where they belong, victims, communities, innovations, and even returning some dollars to the general fund. And the MRRA rewards those for who show that it's not about, again, how much time they spend in prison, but it's how that time is used. At least 38 states around the country have a version of earned incentive and encourages people to engage in these programs. And smart criminal justice investments across the nation, in fact, during the Trump administration, elements of this type of programming was put into legislation. Next, I want to talk about another bill that you've heard and seen before. That's the Intermediate Sentence Review Board, it's a parole board. These are the cases where Minnesota does provide for parole in indeterminate sentence cases. This was also heard last year and passed off the floor. Today, as the Commissioner of Correction, I am the sole decision maker in terms of parole decisions. And Minnesota is one of only four states and across the nation who makes decisions in this way. And over the years, we have approached, when we looked at that sole decision maker, the commissioner being in there, decisions varied widely. In over a 20-year period, the DOC commissioners reviewed roughly the same number of individuals up for parole, but granted them at varying different rates. And today, because of where we find ourselves, we are seeing the number of cases go up and up. As a for instance, in 2022, you will see the most number of people will come before the commissioner and advisory panel than ever before in the history of the DOC. The differences highlights the challenges. Ron, an individual has to make these difficult decisions. We think it's important that we expand the number of qualified people who consider parole going forward. Next, we are seeking the creation of a reimbursement fund for transportation. You heard about this last week. This is a standalone bill, and the standalone bill that was authored by Representative Erdahl, House File 2970, which really provides funding for county sheriffs who have to transport people who violate the terms and conditions of felony probation and maybe living in another state under the Interstate Compact to be transported back to Minnesota as part of that probation revocation process to see the courts here. Next is another project that we are working on with the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. And I want to also thank Representative Edelson for introducing this proposal as a standalone bill, House File 4230. Members have heard from sheriffs across the state about the dire need for mental health resources for individuals incarcerated in county jails who have severe and persistent mental illnesses. This proposal creates a limited time pilot project at the DOC's Oak Park Heights Mental Health Unit to allow counties to place people in that facility on that pretrial basis to allow them to access higher levels of treatment and services while they are pending for court. The pilot would be cost neutral to the state and counties would reimburse the department and those who would qualify for this mental health to ensure that they receive the needed treatment services while they are pending for trial. We've included a reporting component to ensure that we use this as a learning opportunity for the good and the benefit of our state, especially in terms of how we respond to and address the needs of people who have severe and persistent mental illnesses and find themselves in the throes of the criminal justice process. And the DOC really looks at this as a partnership, and we want to use this as a way to learn and then hopefully come back to the legislature to talk about what we learned and see if there's another approach that we could look at to address this on a more permanent basis. Next is this notion of project management. And anyone who's worked in kind of a business environment knows the importance of this. And the DOC we're requesting an investment of $230,000 each fiscal year to add two project managers to help coordinate and drive our transformative work across the divisions, service areas, and facilities. As a large organization with over 44,000 employees, implementing new initiatives, policies, programs is very time-consuming, and we want to make sure it's done consistently across the system. And one of the things that we know is that organizations that use project management practices waste 28 times less money than counterparts who do not use this. The DOC has nearly 40 projects that are in need of this type of project management to make sure that we consistently implement new projects, policies, and so forth along the way. And we feel that this is money well spent and would save dollars in the long haul. Next is property insurance, a very kind of technical aspect in many respects. But as you all know, the Department of Corrections is almost entirely funded by the general fund. And we have, with our state, 11 correctional facilities. We have 336 buildings, and our property and insurance rates have increased 54%. And as such, we're requesting $650,000 annually to keep up with the rising property insurance costs. Now, I want to give some attention to the data infrastructure bill. And we think that this is a project that touches on everything that we do. And I want to thank Representative Mueller for carrying this as a standalone bill, because while we didn't get to it yesterday, I want to spend the rest of my time, just a few more minutes here, providing a high-level overview of it. And with me today to talk about it is Captain Chris Mitchell from DOC's Faribault facility. Members and leaders across Minnesota strive to make data-driven and evidence-based decisions in every field, healthcare, education, housing, and we look to research and data to make those informed decisions. Minnesota is known for that kind of work, and we strive to set an example. But one of the areas that we've struggled in Minnesota and in corrections is that we have to provide the level of technological support to ensure that we're investing in what works and that we know and have accurate data to show our outcomes and to be able to demonstrate what's making us safer or make tweaks for those things that are not. This is really a two-part request. The first component is an investment of $30 million over the next 3 years to really overhaul, rebuild the DOC's fundamental core data management system that is well over 30 years old. It has had investments over time, but it is in peril. And there is serious security challenges that come with this system, and the need to upgrade it is now. And while we have made piecemeal investments over time in order to keep the system operating, it is critical that we rebuild this core system. The second component of this really provides $17 million to create this central hub of information that relates to community supervision. And it's a portal that connects supervision agents and systems, the DOC, the judicial branch, our law enforcement partner, on data sharing in ways that are appropriate and on a need-to-know basis only, and to provide better supervision and to allow communities and law enforcement to be more aware of what's happening across our state with people who are involved in the system. This bill would provide the DOC funding it needs to build this system, and which would help us going decades into the future. Minnesota DOC is an agency that I've often referred to as being data rich, but information poor. In other words, we collect a massive amount of data, but we do not have systems to be able to turn that data into usable information to guide decision-making and where our investments should be or areas that we should discontinue making investments. Today, we still use things like fax machines and those sorts of things to complete much of our duties, and much of the data we collect is still on paper. This investment really provides us with a chance to modernize and really address what's needed in this system. Similarly, requested will create this statewide hub for data collection, allow us to be more have the information of near real-time tracking. In fact, one of the things we've talked about in the past with this committee is things like dosage probation. If I'm on probation and I'm checking into my weekly aftercare program, I would be able to log in and that would be automatically uploaded. My supervision agent would be able to see in near real time that I've checked in at that location and that I was actually in attendance or following and in full compliance with my with all my conditions. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to yield my remaining minutes to MCF Captain, Faribault Captain Chris Mitchell, who can share a few words about this the importance of this project.
Very well, thank you. Very well. Welcome to the committee, Captain. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Chris Mitchell. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Chris Mitchell, and I'm a captain at the Minnesota Correctional Facility in Faribault. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. I've been involved with the State Correctional Facility Security Audit Group, and I just want to thank all of you for keeping the safety and the security of those who work in corrections on your mind the last few years. It has been heartening to see the legislator focus on safety inside our state correctional facilities. External oversight of our security audits and other efforts are great steps, and I'm here today to request that you also pay attention to the OLA's findings about how far behind we are as an agency when it comes to our technology and when it comes to being able to make data-driven decisions on all fronts, security, program releases, and more. We're grateful for your investments and corrections over the years, but as the commissioner has mentioned, with a budget that is over 96% reliant on the general fund, we continue to look to you to fund our technology needs. Mr. Chair, members, without a parallel effort to invest in our crumbling technology infrastructure, there can be no serious attempts towards making a prison setting safe in the 21st century. When DOC staff are still relying on fax machines to share important information, when our base technology is so outdated, we cannot acquire systems to pinpoint problem areas in our facilities and deploy resources accordingly, we cannot enhance the safety of those who work in and live in our facilities. Operating prisons and supervision with such outdated technology should wave a red flag for all of us. We're dealing with 21st century problems, and we need to have 21st century solutions. So let's take security for an example. It's nearly impossible for us to track where there may be pockets of disturbances based on time of day, location, and officer coverage due to the fragmented reporting tracking systems that we have. One is only able to track the disturbances by combing through daily incident reports and combining with historical reports. It is 100% a manual process, and it takes many hours away from our actual jobs. Or let's think about discipline. We have no ability to track an incarcerated person's discipline without reading narrative for these discipline instances. Cannot automatically track instances of staff assault and degrees of assaults. It is a manual process. Further, we are unable to track or report any instances that occur in or outside of our facility and what impact this may have on the other. For example, say an incarcerated person is released and commits a staff assault in the community on one of our agents. That information is not captured as a discipline instance, but it is contained in the hearing and release unit's narrative that will cause the individual to be revoked and returned to prison. Our systems do not talk to each other, so we continue to have these massive gaps. For my colleagues who are case managers and are responsible for release plans of those leaving our facilities, there's no comprehensive way to gather all the information they need. Much of it is in various systems, and a lot of it exists as case notes that take them hours to comb through. For reference, we release between 5,000 to 6,000 people a year from all DOC facilities, so the volume my colleagues are dealing with for release plans is incredibly high. So, Mr. Chair and members, I'm here today because we, the staff responsible for some of the hardest work in state government, and those who have been on the front lines of this pandemic are truly struggling to keep up. The number of man hours it takes to work with antiquated systems we are dealing with could be much better used. I'm here today so you can see that those of us who are dealing with the impact of the lack of investments in technology modernization within the DOC, I know I speak for all of my colleagues when I say we implore you to support this request. Unfortunately, I do need to get back to the facility, so I'll return this to the commissioner, but I'm very grateful you gave me some time to speak to you, and thank you.
Thank you, Captain. I appreciate your being with us today. I appreciate the work that you do and the innovation that you and the passion that you bring to it. Tough work, but very needed work. Thank you very much. With that, Commissioner, I think we're just going to slide into minutes are allowed us here to get into some questions. I do just want to very quickly say that I'm really impressed with the budget request. I think it's a very smart one. It looks to today, but it also looks beyond and very important. Data evidence-based ways. And so I want to commend you for that. I do have questions and concerns around the JRI issue, mainly that, at least in my opinion, I don't think it goes far enough, but we are going to have a hearing on this. And so I'm going to reserve, until that time. And then meantime, we can continue to have a good conversation. Two things very quickly. You and I have spoken about the JDAI transfer issue, and I just want to make sure, quite frankly, here for the record about, what's happening in terms of the pace of the transfer of that. My understanding is that we're going to delay that for a bit, but I just want to make sure to give you an opportunity to share, how that's going to proceed at this point.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that is correct. We're delaying that. We are establishing the state advisory group and in the way that the legislature requires us to do that. We will be engaging with a third party, probably likely the Annie Casey Foundation, to talk about what the future looks like. So that's kind of where we are at this point.
Commissioner, I think it's a really good approach, and I please look for my support in any way I can with that. Thank you very much. The other thing, and I'll just make it more a comment than a question, but you know, obviously the department has been under a lot of stress through the pandemic in ways that other departments have not. That's created, no doubt, a lot of stress. The pandemic has created all sorts of stress and resources in order to meet, you know, those challenges. I see that there's been a request for COVID relief funds from the department to help meet that. I'd like us to continue to have a conversation about what is the intermix between that and the appropriations requests, you know, from our general fund. I just want to make sure I know how all these pieces are going to work together, and also make sure that we're doing the appropriate things that we need to be doing out of general fund, you know, relative to those issues. And so, so I guess my question, but we can come back in a future, near future time, is whether or not there are any COVID relief expenses that the department is looking to have covered elsewhere or through other means. And you don't have to get into that right now, Commissioner, but hopefully we can, you know, have that conversation both offline and also online as we make the decisions around our budget.
I'd appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
All right, very well. With that, let's move on to our questions. Vice Chair Frazier, followed by Representative Otney. Right, Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Schnell, for this presentation. You know, one thing I wanted to go back to was when you focus on the body cameras for DOC officers. You spoke about the safety, but I think another piece that could very well these cameras could be used for is addressing any workplace issues and culture or issues that may be there, sexism, racism, toxic workplace pieces. You can document those things. And for managers, that's very important to be able to address those issues. So thank you for bringing that. And I just wanted to point out, I think it could be not only the safety of the inmates and the of the officers, but also those workplace issues that could be addressed as well. So I'm looking forward to taking a look at that.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frazier. Representative Hawking.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. My question was going to be about the Justice Reinvention Initiative, and sounds like that was covered and that'll be coming up further. So thank you for bringing that to the attention, and so we can get these counties better served with the underfunding. Thank you.
I would just say, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I would just say that, you know, that project has been, you know, remember that your committee really kind of initiated a lot of that last year when you passed and pushed move forward that funding bill to look at the sustainability of correction system funding. And that's what dovetailed with the GRI initiative. And I think we have made some significant progress, and I look forward to the presentation next week.
Very well. And Commissioner, I'm not sure if, I don't think there was a question in Vice Chair Frazier's comments, but I didn't offer you an opportunity to comment on that. And so feel free if you feel you need to. And
well, Mr. Chair, I would just say that I appreciate that. And I acknowledge that comment. You know, one of the things that came up in the OLA report, too, as you recall, was some of the kinds of issues around the female employees, but kind of who are, you know, sexually victimized by folks in you know, people that are in custody. And I think these are all things, both accountability for the system, which we, you know, we know is critical, but it also is about accountability and for, you know, for the people that are inside who are causing some of these harms. So absolutely, we see this as a comprehensive look at this, and I concur.
Very well. I apologize too, Vice Chair. I'm trying to move very quickly here. Unfortunately, sometimes I move too quick.
No worries, Chair.
Very well. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you, Commissioner Schnell. You had just mentioned the legislative auditor report, and it did point out a lot of different things. And now we have the Security Audit Advisory Council, which I will be on in a couple of hours, 1 hour, I believe. We'll be talking about more things in depth. But one of the things that was pointed out there was the data. And so I really appreciate that there's some restructuring of how you gather and collect and are able to use the data there, because that was a really big component, I think, of the OLA that was missing. Something else in the OLA report, which we didn't discuss today, was the hiring of additional corrections officers, the COs. because you just, there was such a lack of coverage. People were getting burned out. We've talked about this at great length. And there wasn't anything in your budget request to add more officers. And my question is, how are we doing with that? And have you been able to hire enough officers? I know that the legislature gave you quite a bit of money to bring that kind of up to where it needed to be. Just wondering how we are with that. And also, how are we with getting back into doing treatment in your walls? And are we still kind of on hold because of the pandemic?
Great question. So, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I'll take the second one first. One of the reasons that, that Commissioner Malcolm and I visited the facility today to talk to some of the staff and as well as the incarcerated, we do have a plan to begin opening up the facilities. We have been providing substance use disorder treatment, sexual offender treatment throughout the pandemic, although at lower numbers because of distancing requirements. So we really, both staff and incarcerated, I can tell you, look forward to getting more into normal operations. And so the facilities have been given, you know, April 4th is to really be in a place where their plans are there to open up as we go forward, to increase the numbers of people in treatment and so forth. So I can tell you unequivocally that based on what I heard today even, what we've known is that the need to get back into this is essential. And so we're there, you will, you know, in April here, you're gonna see significant changes in terms of the openness of our facilities and the availability of people to access different programs. As for the staffing levels, you know, this has been, as we've talked about many times, an area of ongoing challenge. We started out in December of 2019, we had 82 vacancies. There was a point at which we got to up to 280 corrections officer vacancies. During COVID, it was very, very difficult to maintain. People, even when we were hiring, our retention rates were challenged. Now, I again report that over the last, since December, we are seeing our numbers go up steadily. Right now, we have over 100 people that are in training status, and April's Academy looks to be another between 40 and 50 people. So as we go forward here, I think we're seeing those numbers change, and really a large part was we did make a request for additional funding from ARP monies, and that was approved by the committee, which I think you're still on, Representative O'Neill, that allowed us to do some incentives for hiring, and those things have made a big difference. And you know, as we've talked about, we're competing with every other industry, and yet the safety of these facilities, the safety of our staff really depends upon maximizing that. And right now, our numbers are going up and everything's trending in the right rate. We really feel that some of our facilities are fully staffed, and others, we have some challenges, a little bit lower numbers. Some of this may be geographic, just in terms of workforce numbers, but we are making progress. We really look by the summer be in a place where we're close to fully staffed. We're going to do everything we can to get there.
Well, members, I'm being told I have a hard stop in 2 minutes by IT. I'm going to turn to Lee Johnson, who's probably going to close us out just enough for me to adjourn us. But Lee Johnson, we have 2 minutes here, so I apologize, but it is what it is.
Chair Mariani, I understand. Fortunately, just too many issues and not enough time to discuss this. A couple different things. One, we've had a lot of staff assaults in the past. I'm just wondering what the status is on staff assaults from Commissioner Schnell. I know I just found out yesterday of one that happened 2 days ago at the Rush City Prison. Fortunately, the staff was not injured severely. But I'm just wondering if you could provide us a up-to-date list on staff assaults and those issues going on in the prison, and also on staff morale.
All right, so that'll be the last question, but we will continue to have this conversation with the budget when we come back, Commissioner, very quickly.
Yep, we will pull that list together, and I look forward to the opportunity to talk about both morale and those staff assault numbers and what we're doing about it.
Appropriate question, absolutely. Members, I do apologize, but I do also want to thank IT for extending us out for this time in order to get both of these presentations. And this conversation will certainly continue in the coming weeks here, particularly as we get into markup territory. I want to thank all the members for their participation today. I wish you all a terrific weekend. Get some rest, and we'll come back on next Tuesday, and we'll be at this again. Thank you, Commissioner, and to your staff for your presentation and your work today. With that, members and everyone else, this committee stands adjourned.